Thank you, Trevor, for inviting me. Thank you very much. Well, welcome to Turner in Surrey. We might stray over the border occasionally because it was too tempting, because there were things going on in Twickenham and there were things going on in Petworth. But nevertheless, we'll try and keep to Surrey and hopefully tell you something you don't already know, because there's been quite a lot about him, last year being the anniversary year. This is the self-portrait that we know so well. Excuse me. It's the one on the £20 note. This is Turner as a young man. It's the only one that he did, and it probably was to back up his application for the Royal Academy membership. He was not a self-publicist normally, quite the opposite. He didn't seem to like people knowing too much about him. He was a man of contradictions, to quote a biographer, Andrew Bailey, reclusive yet gregarious, private yet boastful, tough yet sensitive. Sounded like a hermit who liked to party. a typical example of the way he avoided the world. In 1841, which was the year of the first census, he rode into the middle of the Thames so that he couldn't be registered at any of his addresses. That might seem extreme to a lot of people, but that's the way he was. This is a timeline that I put together. It's rather condensed, and homing in really on the subject matter around Surrey. So it's a fairly limited timeline. It just gives us a few facts. His birth date is reckoned to be 23rd of April 1775. But there's a dispute about that even, as Turner used to tell different people different dates. Again, as an example of his wish to keep people at a distance. But we do know the year is correct, because last year was his 250th anniversary. What can't be disputed is the date of his baptism, because that's a matter of record. And that is the 14th of May, 1775. That was in St. Paul's Church in Covent Garden. He was at school in Brentford, 1785, where he lodged with an uncle, and he was also at school in Margate, where he stayed with his friends, the Trimmers. Their name comes up quite a lot during the course of his life. He travelled to school on the river, and this may have started his love affair with river travel, and he did become, in fact, a very accomplished oarsman in his own right. His home life was difficult as well. His mother had mental difficulties, and she was eventually consigned to Bedlam Hospital, all very tragically. 1797, we'll start looking at his paintings of Surrey, starting with Leatherhead, where he painted with his friend Tom Girton, and we'll talk about him as well, because he was certainly part of his life. And in 1802, he was elected a Royal Academician. 1805 to 1810, we find that was the period when he painted a lot in Surrey, and he started with Walton, as it was called, a Walton on Thames today, and rowing himself down the River Wey, certainly Guildford. He spent a lot of time there, and down as far as Godalming. 1813, he finished his own house, and we'll look at that as well, Sandycombe Lodge at Twickenham. Again, lovely part of Surrey that's really Middlesex, but it's only just over the border, so it's worth looking at that. Again, a very big part of his life, and also his father's life. He spent almost the last part of his lifetime there. 1819, we look at Richmond, where he painted quite a lot of important pictures, and then 1851 he died. He was living in Chelsea at the time, in extremely squalid surroundings. He died of cholera, and he lived there with his mistress, Sophia Caroline Booth. They lived together as man and wife. And he posed as a retired admiral. In fact, he was known as Admiral Booth. Sophia Booth, actually, it was her house. She bought the house, and it was seen that Turner himself descended into a fairly squalid, miserly existence. His last words were, they're recorded as, "The sun is God." And it was reported that shortly before his death, he crawled to the window so that he could have one last sight of the sun. His gallery in Queen Anne Street was also allowed to fall into disrepair through neglect. Paintings could no longer be sold there. They became too dilapidated, and the premises became too dilapidated. You couldn't allow people in. Although Turner did receive offers, which he turned down. He received an offer of £5,000 for a painting called The Shipwreck, which he refused, and then again he had an offer of £100,000 at the time for the whole collection. That's about £14 million in today's money. And he turned that down as well. He really wanted, he had plans for the collection. He wanted to leave it complete to the nation, to preserve it for posterity, and no doubt consign his own name for future generations to remember. Too often he had seen on the death of fellow academicians that their paintings were squabbled over by family, sold off and dispersed. And I suppose one can say he was successful in that his name is remembered. Not necessarily many more are that he knew at the time. His bequest to the nation amounted to some 300 oil paintings, some 30,000 sketches, including 300 sketchbooks. The will was contested by a cousin, but later, after going to the House of Lords, it was proven. Curiously, the National Gallery, who first received the collection, were not all that thrilled to have it. And it lay around in a basement for many years. They didn't know what to do with it. Max Hastings said it was about 100 years that they lay about, as he tripped over them in 1940, still apparently in the same place. Some paintings were actually given away to other galleries. We are told that one was used to repair a broken window. So much for Turner wanting the collection preserved intact. However, as we know, the final resting place for Turner, for most of his collection, is Tate Britain in the Claw Gallery. And of course they have marvellous special exhibitions as well, like the Turner exhibition last year, and also the one that's on now, Turner and Constable. So, you know, he was successful, really, in what he tried to do. We'll have a look at some paintings. And this is a painting, a watercolour, and it's called... there we are. It's called Possibly Box Hill. Possibly Box Hill. This is the earliest one that I could find. It was attributed to another painter called Tom Girtin. Thomas Girtin was well known and highly respected. Tom Girtin was also born in 1775, so they were the same age, and they were great friends, and they went around together sketching and doing watercolour. They would row out into the Thames and sketch. Put that down. Sketch the ruins of the old Savoy Palace, as well as various rotting hulks along the stretch of the riverbank. Watermen, they were so used to seeing them, they were said to have steered around the two artists at anchor. They were that commonplace. Turner admired Girtin greatly and once said, "If Tom had lived, I would have starved." Tom Girtin died very young. He was aged 27. His cause of death variously reported as asthma, consumption, or ossification of the heart. Later on, this painting was attributed to Turner in 1796. Goethe's paintings can be seen still in the Claw Gallery next to Turner's. So they were very close at one period. Their style, I think, is very similar. I understand that it was attributed wrongly in the beginning. This is, we're still in the Leatherhead area. This is a painting of the River Mole at Leatherhead. About this time, Turner was often a guest of William Locke, who was a wealthy amateur artist and collector. In 1774, Locke had purchased Norbury Park outside of Leatherhead. I suppose you know it. It's the park is still there. I don't know about the house. I'm not sure. He had built his house there. Locke and his wife were well known in society. Frances Burney, Fanny Burney, the novelist, was a close friend, and the Locks were instrumental in her meeting her future husband, the Comte d'Arblay. He was an emigre from the Revolution, and he lived at Juniper Hall on Box Hill, as did plenty of other emigres, like Madame de Stael was one, and there were others, I know. I don't know whether Fanny Burney ever met Turner. Interesting to conjecture. I couldn't find anything to say that she did. And also Jane Austen was a constant visitor at the time. Whether they met up at all, I don't know. The Locks helped the D'Arblays materially, it is said. Camellia Cottage, which they built, was on land belonging to the Locks. And the Locks were close to artists like Turner. And interesting that his work appealed to them so much, because this is his student period. He's only a young man, he's about 20. And very accomplished work, I believe, for someone of that age. Then also at Norbury, there's this one. This is Beech Trees at Norbury, again a watercolour, again very accomplished work. Today it's in the National Gallery of Ireland as one of 31 Turner paintings that were bequeathed to the gallery by a man called Henry Vaughan in 1900. I don't know anything about him other than he must have possessed these pictures. Turner would have been 22 when he painted this. Quite a mature style, really. I know he'd been painting probably since a boy, but nevertheless, very, very good, very good work he was doing even at that young age. And then this is landscape, again painted at Norbury Park. Landscape with old oak, mid 1970s, and today it's in the Metropolitan Museum of New York. This is an interesting man who had a very great influence on Turner and Thomas Girton and many others. This is Dr. Monroe. Turner and Girton, as I say, had a very good patron, Dr. Monroe, who was connected to the area. He had a country house in Bell Lane in Fetcham until 1805. Turner and Girton and other artists would often go and stay there, and they painted together in the Leatherhead area in watercolour, as we've seen, and also, as we see later, sometimes accompanied by Dr. Monroe, who was a great art lover and an art supporter. He was a doctor, he was a principal physician of the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, and one-time consultant to George III during his period of madness. He didn't actually treat the king, but he did make suggestions and he acted as a consultant. One of his recommendations was to give the king a pillow stuffed with hops to calm him at night. and to give him a good night's sleep. He formed what was known as the Monroe Circle for aspiring artists, and was himself an art collector and an amateur artist. Thomas Monroe was one of five generations of physicians who practiced at the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, and the family played a prominent part in the management of the insane in the 18th century and the 19th century. His passion, however, was art, and it was at his house in Adelphi Terrace on the banks of the Thames at Charing Cross that from 1794 he would host young artists on winter Friday evenings, retaining their work and giving them 3 and 6 months and a supper of oysters. Many of these artists would become leading artists of the day. Thomas Monroe's discovery of the young Turner is described in a biography of a man called Arthur Sabin. I don't know who he is, and I couldn't find out, but nevertheless, he records this incident, which is interesting for us. Dr. Monroe was riding his cob down Maiden Lane in Covent Garden, and he saw drawings stuck up in the window of Turner the barber. This was Turner's father, old Dad, as he called him. He rapped on the pane with his stick and inquired within. "They are by my son," said Mr. Turner proudly. "He is just 16 and works for John Raphael Smith, the engraver, colouring mezzotints." "Send him round to me of an evening," said the doctor, "and he can get some practice with other artists and make friends with them." And that is what he did quite a lot of. And here we have a sketch of Turner made by Dr. Monroe himself. What he often did, he worked with, with Tom Girton. Tom Girton would sketch and the young Turner would colour very often as almost a partnership. Monroe's house became a studio, turning out sketches, often in a blue-grey wash, and monochrome copied from drawings by more established artists like John Robert Cousins and the many others, including Monroe's neighbour, John Henderson. Cousins is well known. I couldn't really get to grips with John Henderson. Cousins especially had an effect on Girton and Turner, as he painted in watercolour in atmospheric style. Monroe taught the young artists accuracy in drawing, accompanying them on outdoor trips and teaching them to see from nature, as well as giving them an opportunity to share ideas with one another. So the lessons in observation, obviously, which is so important, but then fairly new thinking compared with the work at the times was often very cliched, copying stuff and the like. You can see the way leading to Impressionism. A lot of the tactics that they were using sort of led to that direction. He would buy sketches from Turner for half a crown and ended up with several hundred of them. You have to wonder what became of them. As such, Thomas Monroe played a key role in the development of the styles of these young artists. John Ruskin went so far as to say that Thomas Monroe was, was Turner's true master, and his academy was the catalyst in the change of styles in watercolours that took place around the beginning of the 19th century. Not many would challenge John Ruskin. Yet Turner was not forced to go to Dr. Monroe's, and he must have felt the need for what some would describe as a fairly humdrum experience. There was something to be said about copying other artists' work, that he could absorb their techniques. Turner was influenced by all this to become market-led. I think he became a marketing man, really. and this sort of basis would set him up. Understanding what was required rather than trying to impose some of his own ideas. Some could not understand the attraction of going to Dr. Munro's just for pocket money, to which Turner would reply, well, and what would be better practice? One must remember, too, that his own home life was very far from congenial, owing to his mother's mental problems, so maybe these weekly outings were a welcome break for him. Turner referred to Dr. Munro as the good doctor. In actual fact, he wasn't a good doctor and was dismissed from the Bedlam Hospital for bad treatment of the patients. We're not told how exactly, but if you can conjure up the image from Hogarth's painting of the Rake's Progress, with the inmates naked and chained as they were in those days and being mocked by casual visitors, then maybe that was it. So that then is Leatherhead, and we're just going to go over to Richmond Hill to look at this particular painting, which was an important one. Excuse me if I just have a sip. This is a painting of 1819. His student days are behind him. He's painting in oils, as we can see, has been for a while. This is the Richmond Hill on the occasion of the Prince Regent's birthday. It's in Tate Britain now. A very important and a very large painting. This was displayed in 1819 at the Royal Academy summer exhibition at Somerset House. This was the largest work that Turner had presented so far. This was a real event on Richmond Hill, hosted by Lady Cardigan at Cardigan House on the 12th of August, 1817. Petersham Meadows is on the bend on the left. Across the river is Turner's own house in Twickenham. Some say you can see it. I never could, but it would be about over there somewhere in the trees. Sandycombe Lodge, which we shall look at later. Ham House is visible in the distance. Described by a biographer as Watteau-esque. I didn't know anything about Watteau and I had to look this up, but I believe from what I read that Watteau, a French painter, is credited with creating the genre of fête galante and scenes of bucolic and idyllic charm, which they certainly had here. So there we are. This was a quite transparent attempt to gain royal favour, royal patronage, and it was unsuccessful. This painting is probably the largest that Turner had ever completed. King size, no pun intended. Something like 10 feet by 6 feet. Huge, huge painting. Too large for his general run of clients, so he obviously had a royal palace in mind for it. That's not where it ended up. When he was king later, King George IV, he did use Turner to depict a seascape, the Battle of Trafalgar. Turner was fascinated by the sea and skilled in painting the sea in all its moods. Another wonderful painting at the time was The Death of Nelson. The victory, when it came return from the battle, came into Chatham and was tied up at Chatham. And Turner went aboard. He didn't make an appointment or anything, he just went there. And he spoke to seamen who had been at the battle. And they were happy enough to describe the scene of where Nelson lay, and also to point out the damage to the flagship. The mizzen mast, I believe, at the time was down. So he had quite a lot of imagery, and I've no doubt he did sketches there, to sort of recreate, if you like, the death of Nelson, became a very famous painting. The Battle of Trafalgar is in Tate Britain. That was part of the Turner bequest of 1856. And it is tempting to think that Turner left in his bequest all his unsold paintings, but Turner was prolific. He did a heck of a lot of stuff, which he had to leave behind. Some of them were sketches, but mostly first-class studio paintings as well, which were just, as I always say, they don't meet their buyer. Let's have a look at... I talked about Sandringham Lodge. This is the house he built for himself with help. It's now, at the time, it was in rolling countryside, but now it's in Sandringham Road. There's a group of pictures really to look at. That's his house as it is today. This is an interesting window which they created near the back of the house, and that is the view that Turner would have had. So you've got the garden, the well, and the fields at the back. Just hovering above it is a brick, the side of the brick house next door, creeping through. But interesting the way they've done that. And that's my very bad photograph. He collected model ships, which he used to paint battle scenes from. They were in glass cases. And this is Orleans House, which played a part in his life. And that's down on the river. It's not far from Sandringham Lodge. That's called Orleans House because the Duke d'Orléans lived there. He was a refugee from the French Revolution. He later was invited back to France as king. He became King Louis-Philippe. He lasted a little while there and had to leave again. didn't come here again, but he did die in exile in England finally. Turner met him, they became very good friends, and they liked to talk about art and such like. Just a bit of a story of, go back to Sandringham Lodge. He started designing this house in 1810. He'd already rented properties in the area, but he aspired to having his own house. Twickenham, as I said before, a lovely part of Surrey, which was really Middlesex, was at the time very rural and offered a retreat from city life. People he knew were nearby, Sir Joshua Reynolds, his friend, his very good friend, John Soane, lived not far away. He was an architect, as you know, and he helped Turner quite a lot with the planning and the building. And there's quite a lot of sort of John Soane details in the house, which I didn't get pictures of at the time. Horace Walpole lived not far away, and also Turner's old friends, the Trimmers, I mentioned them, that used to be in Marco, they weren't far away either. So he had quite a lot going on around about. He was first rated for the house in 1813, we're told, and he sold the house in 1826, citing his father's health as the reason, but really, in fact, he wasn't spending much time there. About then, he was going abroad to Europe quite a lot and quite long journeys. After 1815, as I say, he could travel to Europe painting and sketching and therefore was out of the country. He went to the Low Countries in Germany, and in 1819 he travelled across the Alps and through Italy. which was a tremendous influence on his painting, Venice especially. And he also travelled extensively at home. The railways, which were later to swallow up his little meadow, because round and about, if you don't know it, it's very much commuter land of the Victorian period. The railways, which were later to swallow up his meadow and Sandringham Lodge itself, were the houses of the new social group, namely commuters. Turner used the railways quite a lot, and they took him on what he thought were exciting journeys, and inspired his paintings. Rain, Steam and Speed is the one that's very famous, of 1844. His father kept house at Sandringham, provisioning from Brentford, gardening, chasing little boys who were looking for birds' eggs, and as well as cooking for his son. So an energetic retirement the old man had, although he seemed very happy there. And he also went daily to open up the studio in Queen Anne Street and would complain of the cost of commuting to London. Though nothing changes. One day he appeared especially chirpy, and when asked why, he replied, "Why, look here. I have found a way at last of coming up cheap from Twickenham to open my son's gallery. I found out the inn where the market gardeners baited their horses. I made friends with one of them, and now, for a glass of gin a day, he brings me up in his cart on top of the vegetables." Father and son shared a habit for frugality. I don't know how he got back, but he was also seen working in the garden, so I don't understand how he was able to do that. In 1826, Turner removed his father to Queen Anne Street, where the old man died in 1829. Twickenham suited Turner and his love for fishing and picnics. Again, this recluse who always enjoyed good company. Here he entertained his fellow academicians. Turner was a stalwart member of the Academy Club, whose subscriptions were 2 guineas a year. They held gatherings at which negus was the principal drink, and negus was apparently a mulled wine, probably made from port. Spices were added, principally nutmeg. The club frequently took to the river, down to Greenwich for a whitebait dinner, or upriver for a summer excursion. In 1819, they were afloat from Westminster Bridge in the Board of Ordnance barge with the professional oarsmen doing the rowing. There is a quotation on the proceedings of the day by someone called Farrington, which is long, and I will quote from. He says, "After supping at Barnes, where we had a loaf and cheese in the boat, we then proceed to Eel Pie House at Twickenham, where we landed a little after 3 o'clock, and about 4 sat down to excellent fare brought from the Freemasons Tavern. We dined in the open air at the table and removed to another to drink wine and eat fruit. Before 7 o'clock, we embarked again and rowed down the river, the tide in our favour, and a full moon." Turner and Westmacott, who's another of them, were very loquacious on their way back, it was said. Also, when he lived at Sandringham Lodge, he saw a lot of his old friends, the Trimmers, and he would go on sketching expeditions with them in his gig, pulled by his faithful pony, Old Cropier, and the pony, which died later, was buried at Sandringham, no one knows where. The rest of his Surrey travels are from 1802 to 1818, and we'll start looking at those, if I get the right. And this is a painting a lovely painting, I think. This is called Two Bridges, and it's at Walton. They didn't call it Walton-on-Thames in those days, but this is at Walton. I don't know where these bridges were exactly. I just could not find out. But this, I think I've said before, I always thought Turner was a marketing man. He loved painting architecture, so he would have loved painting the bridges. But at the same time, he put in a pastoral scene in the foreground, which sort of widens the scope of the painting and widened the appeal and widening the saleability of it. So he's got cattle coming down to the river, which probably weren't there, little boats and all sorts, all with his bridges, which he enjoyed painting. He talks about the arches, the parabola arches, which are I always had to look up what a parabola was. It's that sort of pointy, funny shape. I always think of a parabola, and there are discussions about this. If you get a jet of water going up from the ground, it goes up and then falls. It's a sort of, not quite a point, but a sort of a soft point. And he was criticised for the way he did them. And critics, they were all very critical of each other at the Royal Academy. They said he crushed the arches. Well, you can talk about that as long as you like. This was an episode when Turner became obsessed by reflections in the water, and his notebooks are filled with convoluted theories, which, when boiled down, maintain that when water is rippled, reflected objects are elongated, and that the theory of the looking glass is not relevant when dealing with reflections in flat water. That sounds fairly obvious, but anyway, that was treated as something revolutionary. If he stated that they are treated in this manner, then they are, in inverted commas, most fallacious to the great book of nature. So that's his view on the subject. This is a point he concludes poignantly: when painting, art toils after truth in vain. He does get very flowery sometimes, I think, but anyway, that was his view. He was certainly making the case for observation rather than reproducing some idealised concept. Or in other words, he was almost saying you can't make a painting look like a photograph, and there we are, fair enough. He's known to have stayed at the Swan Hotel in Walton, which is still there. The Swan was built in 1770. I looked at the Swan's website and could find no mention of their illustrious guest. They either don't know about it, or they don't think it was very important. But he was known to have stayed there, and that comes up in his in various biographies. They're moving from the Thames to... We're now going to go down the way. No, sorry, this is another Thames picture. This is the Thames near Walton Bridge. That's a bit more sketchy, I think. He would paint on situ. A lovely painting. Doesn't come up to the other one, I don't think, the other, in my opinion. This is getting closer to home, and this is probably a scene you will recognise anyway. This is Newark Priory. He called it Newark Abbey, and it's framed in Tate Britain and faithfully labelled, the name is beautifully carved in it, as Newark Abbey, which, of course, we know it was Newark Priory. Not much different to today, really. It's the Abbey Church, or what's left of it. What does he say? This is a view, as I say, we know well. It's much the same today. Guildford historians will know it well, as I seem to remember it was excavated by Surrey Archaeological Society. Several people that I knew have been involved in excavations there. It's on private land even today. It's very, very difficult. You can't just, they're usually cattle and what have you, being grazed there. And it's, you can't go up to the ruins even if you wanted to. And I know people have tried, and it's very, very difficult to get access. But there again, I painted a similar view, which I later recycled because it wasn't very good. And I put cows in mine, and someone said my cows looked quite wooden. So I thought I'd better destroy it, which I did. Turner's cows are very, very good compared to mine. Newark Priory, if you know that stretch of the river, and you sort of just come up, you know, even if you're on the towpath, you just come up on it suddenly. It was a sort of view I could imagine Turner being quite impressed by. He did several shots of this. Of this, you know, of this particular view, and there's more than one in Tate Britain, and other places. He was drawn to old buildings, as I've said, especially ruins, which we see very often. And he used to row himself. Certainly down the River Wey, and he would sleep on the boat very often. He did stay at inns, the Swan and Walton I mentioned, and he also stayed at the White Lion in Guildford. But very often he would think nothing of bedding down at the bottom of his boat. He did, this was an oil sketch. I didn't know, I don't paint in oils myself, I didn't know that, especially then, I didn't know that people did sketches on site, on plain art, as it were, in oil, but he did, and it's worth noting because we're told how he did them. He would carry with him some mahogany boards together with linseed oil and bladders full of paint. He also took 4 by 3 feet canvases rolled up in the boat, which he would later pin to boards to work on. He was in fact in the vanguard of an open air movement. Plein air, as it was later called, and I always think of him as the first impressionist. I don't think I'm necessarily agreed with. Others more qualified call him the father impressionist. The movement included other Thames Valley painters that we know, William de la Motte and William Havel, both watercolourists, and the East Anglian John Constable. That's a curious term for constable, isn't it? If we just call him Constable. But at the time, Constable wasn't very well known, and he was referred to as the East Anglian John Constable. And Turner, on these occasions, would use his oils like watercolours, sometimes not using a ground on the boards, but just letting the colours run into one another, wet on wet. This sketch of Newark Priory is in Tate Britain, as I've said. He did do others of a similar view. And another one is in the Yale Centre of British Art in Connecticut. This is apparently the largest collection in North America of Turner paintings. And there is yet, as I've said before, there is yet another view in Tate Britain. Not just rowing in Surrey, of course. I've just said to him, he was a very, very skilled oarsman. But he rowed as far as Oxford down the Thames, where he painted Christchurch, and he also rowed downriver in the Thames as far as the Medway, where he sketched the warships, and his sketchbooks there have got stained by water. Very choppy waters, he would have had a bigger boat probably there, and may well have taken someone with him. Maybe old Dad came with him and held the boat steady while he sketched the boats, sketched the ships. quite a lot of planning obviously went on these trips that he did. So we'll go on to Guildford. This is a well-known view of Quarry Street, and this is not Turner. This is one of mine, which I've just put in, just to... well, thank you if you thought it was, but it's not. It's the opening to Quarry Street. But the link there, I had to, when I took a reference photograph, there is a link with Turner. I stepped back into White Lion Walk to keep the sun off the camera lens. And of course, that is the link, because we go on from there to this one. And that is Turner. And he was staying at the White Lion Hotel. This is, in fact, one from Turner's sketchbook, which I have actually seen in an exhibition. I didn't take this. Tate Britain were kind enough to send me this one. I have actually seen it. He was staying at the White Lion in 1805, and he was on the second floor, so he was higher than me at the time, in his room, much the same as, the shot is much the same as today. Got the building on the left. I always think of it as the travel agent's Thomas Cook, which it isn't anymore. The church, obviously. The church then, you can just see the East End coming out into Quarry Street. It was pulled down not long after he would have seen it, to widen the road, and you got the castle in the background, and a sort of there's a sort of another little tower next to, looks as though it's next to the castle. It's in another painting later on. It's not actually that near, but it just appears. Friends of mine in the Guildford museums thought it was part of the House of Correction, but I don't know. I'm not really sure what that was at the time, but it's certainly not there now. It's got some other drawings too. This is Guildford High Street, which is a Turner sketch. On the left, well, the Guildhall, obviously. He's left the clock out, but never mind. St Nicholas Church at the very bottom. And what is probably the old Tun Hotel, which was there. Tunsgate Arch, as we know, wasn't built till 1819, so this predates it by a few years. There's that one. And this is another of his sketches of Guildford. This is quite an early one. In the 1790s, he must have done this on a trip out with Dr. Munro, I suppose. But again, a very nice little sketch with the proportions and everything. Perspective was a big thing of his, which he always got right. Then he painted St. Catherine's Fair. I've not got much information on this painting. St. Catherine's Chapel, as we know it today still, and that road, which is the Portsmouth Road, then, I suspect, as it is today. He depicts the chapel in dramatic weather and with a bustling fair in the foreground, in a watercolour of 1830 for the picturesque views of England and Wales. One of his books that he put together. And this is in the Yale Centre for British Art in New Haven, Connecticut as well. I think I've said the Yale Centre houses the largest collection of Turner paintings in North America. I couldn't find As I say, not much information do I have on that one. More information on this other picture of St. Catherine's, which is this one. There are several references that people have made about this particular painting, or became an engraving. A lady called Gillian Forrester, who is an art historian. And she wrote about Turner's drawings and the books he put together. He put together something called Liber Studiorum, and I think if you gave something a Latin title, it increased its appeal. But basically, a book of studies, and he would put them together as prints, and they sold separately, and they sold very well, generally. As I say, it gave him an additional income. He was more of a businessman than many other artists of the day. She mentioned, Gillian Forrester, that is, this particular picture, which was a watercolour, later engraved by a man called J.C. Easling, one of the engravers that Turner used. Throughout his lifetime, Turner used something like 61 different engravers. And of course we tend to forget that Turner was an accomplished engraver himself anyway. He was as good an engraver as he was a painter. You know, he could keep them up to the mark. Turner and J.C. Easling jointly published this one as an etching and as a mezzo tint in 1811. As I say, he was as much a printmaker as he was an artist. Printmaking gave him three opportunities to make money. And Turner was a businessman. Art was his business. An example which sticks in my mind is a painting called The Shipwreck. We mentioned it earlier. When he sold it, he sold the original for 300 guineas. But he wouldn't let the buyer have it immediately. And he loaned it to an engraver. And there was a fee for that of 25 guineas. The engraving was pre-sold, and there were 130 copies made. 130 copies were sold before it was made. And a print would go for between 2 and 4 guineas a time. So you could start to see that already he was making more from those than he was for the original painting. And this was only the first print run. So he did make, in his time, quite a lot of money. He didn't spend a lot of money on frivolous things, but he did invest. So I don't know what his net, his cash worth was, as well as his paintings that he left behind. This one was taken from sketches made in the what he called the Spithead sketchbook. It was generally thought to have been made in Turner's round trip from London to Portsmouth and back again in October and November of 1807, although Turner had already recorded the chapel in the Way Guildford sketchbook of 1805. So it was a place he knew quite well. Ruskin compares this work favourably with Turner's continental work, and someone called Stopford Brooks, we don't really know a lot about him, waxes lyrical about the spiritual power he detected in the chapel's presence. Stopford Brooks, he was a clergyman, and he was also a painter. And we have his quote. As I say, he does get quite carried away by it. "It stands broken and sorrowful, the witness of a bygone faith, roofless, windowless, but at peace. It has done its work for man and God, and Turner paints it in its ruined rest. As in the Dunstanborough, the Dunstanborough refers to a castle in the northeast. You may well know it anyway, Dunstanborough Castle, where he did a similar thing. As in the Dunstanborough, he has here also laid the sheep about the hill to increase the impression of quiet. It is no picturesque place. Turner paints English life as it was, and the struggle of the poor is uppermost in his mind in all these rustic projects. He paints them at the hour of rest, and the sense of its consolation broods over this little world. I'm not that convinced that that's what he was thinking at the time. I think he was thinking this is quite a saleable view. I am known to be cynical. As I say, Turner was interested in saleable images. And this is one of those, this is probably one of his most well-known prints, and is often mentioned. Let's go on to the next painting on the way. And this is Guildford Castle again. This is Guildford from the South. Guildford from the South, and it was painted in 1805, and it's in Tate Britain. And it shows what to me is this mysterious tower on the right hand side. The castle is clear. I don't know what that tower was. It's not St Mary's, obviously, because that's down there, and it can't be Holy Trinity, because that's, I don't think anyway, unless he's moved it. I mean, artists do move things, I know. I mentioned Turner just tying up on the riverbank and doing a quick study, maybe making himself some food, and maybe sleeping on the boat. He might have done that here, he might well have done, or he might just have come out from the White Lion, I don't know, but that's the sort of thing that I can imagine him doing. Whether he really did, I just don't know. Apparently he did finish this painting afterwards, we're told, in the studio. But the tower that I was curious about is even more pronounced in this painting than it was on the drawing which I showed you earlier. And this is a view of Godalming. And we're getting close to the end of his river way. I'm not really sure where he was. Looks as though he's on the roadside, but looking down into Godalming, there's the church, that's clear. Very accomplished sketch of the church tower with just a very few strokes. He's done the spire. I think Godalming church spire is or was in lead, so it would have been that silver grey colour. And then maybe right out on the hill, could that be St Catherine's? Or again, he could move them around, nothing to stop him doing that. It's an outdoor sketch in oil, but it's beautifully done, I think, for a quick painting. I don't actually have any information on this painting. It's only what I surmise, really. And this is really the end of his journey into Surrey. I could find nothing else that he did in Surrey. He was prolific, as we know, and he worked abroad a lot as well, so there was much to come. This is Petworth showing Capability Brown his lake. And Turner, as we know, did a lot of work at Petworth. I won't go into the full story, just a few of these pictures. It worked for Lord Egremont, who was a very great patron. He had his own studio there. He was very well thought of. There were other painters there, but and that's the same view today. But the interesting ones, I think, are the paintings that he did, which are in the carved room. And this is Brighton from the Sea. This is where he started, well, this is where he started. This is one of those instances where he came up against John Constable. And Constable, you probably know, lived for a while in Brighton. His wife was very ill. They moved to Brighton for her health. And he painted the chain link pier. He painted it from the shore. Turner was alarmed when he saw that painting because the chain link pier was one of those projects that Lord Egremont was involved in, which he partly financed. And although he was very jealous of his relationship with Petworth, with Lord Egremont, and although there were other, excuse me, other artists involved, Constable was seen as the greatest challenge. So he got his opportunity to come back when Lord Egremont decided to extend the carved room and make it into a long dining room. And he was commissioned to do some paintings of A, the house, Turner this is, A, the house, and B, projects that Lord Egremont was involved in. Turner went one better than Constable, and Turner being Turner, he went out to sea and did the view from the sea. He called it Brighton by the Sea, but really and truly, I think it's a picture of the chain link pier, because you could hardly see Brighton in the mist, but it's a wonderful picture of the pier. And he produced six paintings for Lord Egremont to choose from, and they were samples, but each painting was a painting that anyone would be proud of. And Lord Egremont chose four, changed certain things, and Turner did them again. It is, as I say, is ostensibly the chain link pier. There are people running up and down the pier. You can't tell too much from the shot. There are fishermen landing their catch. It's quite a busy scene, and it's, I think, the intention of Turner's intention was to trump Constable on that one. He doesn't say so, but it sort of stands out, really. And the other painting, and we'll finish on this one, is Chichester Canal. It's a beautiful picture, I think. And those two, there's four in the carved room. They're positioned about waist high because it was a dining room, and people were expected to look at them from a seated position. But these two are the ones that were, again, another project that Lord Egremont was involved in. Chichester Canal was an extension of the Wey Arran, as you know, and then it went on into Chichester Harbour and across to Portsmouth, into the Portsmouth Canal system. Lovely silhouette of the cathedral in the background. Beautiful, beautiful painting. Does he say anything much about it? No, only really roughly what I've just said. That was those two are in Petworth. That was just a mention. There are other paintings there, of course. So it wasn't really about Petworth. The subject today was Surrey. I just tacked those on, and that really brings us to the end of our little voyage. and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.